Tim McNally. Welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Happy Thursday, everybody. Welcome to the unofficial start of the weekend here in the Crescent City. Thanks for tuning in. If you're listening here on WGSO 990 AM, I appreciate it. And of course, if you're listening a little bit down the road from Thursday, April 4th here on our podcast, I certainly appreciate that too. Thank you very much, friends, for tuning in as always here on the NOLA Drinks Show with Brian Diaz. And yes, friends, it is that weekend here in town. Beautiful weather. We could not ask for better, more beautiful, if there is such a thing, weather than what we have coming up the next 4 days for what is my favorite festival, my favorite music festival going on. And that is, of course, French Quarter Festival, friends. Kicks off, it actually kicked off today at 11 o'clock, and it goes through Sunday until, I think about 7 or 8 o'clock. And wow, free festival all throughout the French Quarter, maybe a little bit beyond that. We'll talk about that in a second. And a whole bunch of stages, 20-something stages, 25 stages, I think, give or take these days. And it's all regional music, friends. You cannot ask for anything better than that. You have Zydeco stuff, you have R&B stuff, you have blues, you have hip-hop, you have traditional stuff, Dixieland stuff, all kinds of great stuff going on out there. And that's where we're going to be. So actually, here in full disclosure, we recorded much of the show on Tuesday, as we do once a month over at Bakery Bar for their service industry brunch. And we'll get to that in the next segment a little bit. And then we'll start that actually in the third segment. This little bit that you're hearing right now is a little bit earlier on the day, Thursday morning here, because every year this is something that I go do. And man, I don't miss French Quarter Festival for anything. So we're going to be out there at the fest all weekend long. So I hope you don't mind that we took care of this stuff this morning, getting you the show, and hope to see you out there at the festival. Want to talk a little bit about the festival itself. This is the 34th annual French Quarter Festival, and it's run by a group called French Quarter Festival Incorporated. They also do the Satchmo Fest, which happens every August. That one's in its 17th iteration coming up. I didn't realize it had been around quite that long. That's grown. Speaking of growing, the French Quarter Festival has grown considerably way back when. So as I said, it's the 34th annual French Quarter Festival. The idea was hatched in 1983, and the first French Quarter Festival took place in 1984. Now, when it first started out, and I've gotten a couple conflicting reports. I got to find out the real answers for this for you. Hope I can get that back to you next week on the show. It certainly started out, one report I read said that it was actually over 3 days. Maybe some of you locals remember out there. I wasn't here at that time. And that there was, it doesn't even really say how many stages. I've also heard that it was only 1 or 2 days, and there was only one stage in Jackson Square when it first started. So a little bit hazy there, but we'll get some answers for you. Point was, it was really small, okay, and we didn't really have a whole lot going on. It was probably attended by just a few hundred people was the estimate at the time, and the whole idea wasn't necessarily as it is today to celebrate the music and culture and things like that of Southeast Louisiana and New Orleans. It was really more of a celebration, and it was dedicated, I don't know if he hatched the idea per se, but Ernest Dutch Morial, the former mayor at that time of New Orleans, wanted to have this festival. This was the reason why they had it, was that it was actually to commemorate about $7.2 million worth of street repairs throughout the French Quarter being completed. And there was several weeks of construction on the streets, which I'm sure, as you can imagine, which goes on now, jacked a lot of stuff up. So that sounds like cause for celebration, just about like anything around here. And it was 14 weeks of construction, to be specific. And that was the whole impetus for the festival. And it was interesting because, again, I said it was only maybe a few hundred people that came into the area. And there were some interesting things, such as Ed McMahon guest hosted a battle of the bands on one of the stages. Apparently, also, there was a break dancing as well as a flash dancing competition. So there was a lot of kind of funky stuff that went on. But, you know, today we move a little bit forward, of course, 34 years removed, and a lot of these traditions remain. One of them is that the Dukes of Dixieland has played, I believe, every French Quarter Festival. They played at the first one, and they're playing at this one, so that's pretty cool. And they'll be going on. I'm not sure what stage they're on, but you can find that out. And by the way, their website is fqfi.org. Pretty neat stuff. Of course, Lots of great food out there, friends. If you're looking for food, you can't miss on that front all throughout the different parts of the whole French Quarter and surrounding areas. Today, as we move forward, last year's estimated attendance was over 760,000 people. The festival has also grown where, you know, now Thursday is pretty much a full day. Not all of the 20-something stages are in action. It's five or six stages, but it starts at 11 o'clock and goes until 6:45. Tomorrow is a full day with probably about two-thirds of the stages in action. And then Saturday and Sunday are just absolutely full on. All stages going all day. So you'll find little stages. Again, if you're from around here and you've been, you probably know. But if you're listening to the podcast and you don't know, it's free, as I said. And the nice thing is you can just kind of mill throughout the French Quarter. There's a stage down in Spanish Plaza. It's, you know, a little bit outside the quarter. It's also a new stage this year, the Jack Daniel's stage, which is apparently right on Decatur in front of Jack's Brewery. So that'll be interesting. They've been closing Decatur for a while during the festival. So it's not really too much of an inconvenience, I guess. But that should be a pretty big stage, judging by some of the acts that I see going on there, including, I believe, Aaron Neville's playing or had played at 3 o'clock today, just as we're starting this show. There you go. So anyway, about 760,000 people last year, tremendous size. 23 stages to be exact. They're estimating that at least 37 states were represented last year and at least 12 countries. I can tell you by wandering around and checking out the international stage, which is in the French Market area and some of these other spots, that there are people from way more than 12 countries here. You have people from all over, from various Asian countries, European countries, and I'm sure well beyond that as well. So it's become a very extensive festival. As I mentioned, there's food. You can go to Jackson Square. A lot of our local restaurants and other food vendors are out serving food. There's four stages along the river, two in Waldenburg Park, the Louie Louie Pavilion, or what used to be called that. I think it's the hand grenade stage now. Oh my. That's there. And then there's also one down by the aquarium in Spanish Plaza. And wow, so there's food all throughout there. If you are looking for crawfish, because we are in the middle of crawfish season, oh yeah, we got that too. If you head up, if you want crawfish, this is where to go. You head up to the old U.S. Mint building. There are two stages there. Those are two of the best stages. The one right on the Esplanade side of the Mint is called the Esplanade in the Shade stage. That's a great place to just go set up your lawn chairs because it's in the shade, stays a little bit cooler, although the weather's going to be really nice this year. And I believe it'll be Rouse's again, but pretty much every year lately, Rouse's is out there boiling crawfish, and you can just get the big old trays and sit out there and enjoy some great music. That's usually where like a lot of the brass bands are, and some of the very, you know, contemporary local music and stuff as well goes on those stages. But you can walk down Royal Street. There's two or three stages there doing a lot of the traditional jazz stuff, which is always a good time. And then various other stages. There's the Cajun Zydeco stage, just a little bit up from Jack's Brewery right there. I want to say that's probably Conti or so, right about where that stage is. So a whole bunch of stuff going on. Now, another cool thing that you can actually do, and one of the reasons why I love French Quarter Festival so much, is that, yeah, as I said, it's free. You want to support the vendors, and that's how you do it. You buy some beers, you buy some daiquiris, you buy some food. But then, hey, if you want to sit down and have a good cocktail, you want to have a proper sit-down meal, you want to get into some air conditioning, again, I don't think we're going to need that this year. You can do that, and you can just pop into one of your favorite French Quarter establishments and chill out for a little while. Use the restroom. There's a good thing. So, yeah, it's a great festival, friends. I'm certainly not doing it justice, but I can't tell you how excited I am to be out there. We'll have some more news. We'll talk about it next week after the festival's over, and certainly watch our social media, Noel Drinks, because I'm going to be taking pictures and posting stuff throughout the festival all weekend long. Hope to see you. If you see us out there, come say hi. Friends, come on back to the Noel Drinks Show. We got a little bit on news and information, and then we'll get into our bakery bar segment. Come on back.
Dad's been shucking dozens since 42. Iron tub ice down full of Falstaff.
Oregon wines are taking over New Orleans. The reason? They're delicious. Next time you're shopping for wine, grab a bottle of Sass Wine. Located in the South Salem Hills of Oregon's Willamette Valley, Sass Wine produces small amounts of handcrafted, high-quality wines that include Pinot Noir, Pinot Blanc, Pinot Gris, Chardonnay, Riesling, Sauvignon Blanc, and Rosé of Syrah. A perfect balance of full fruit with fine, supple tannins and firm acidity is what makes truly great wines, and you'll find that in every bottle of Sass wine you drink.
Time for lunch? We've got you covered at Sobu.
Chef Juan Carlos whipped up special two-course lunches that start at $14.
Try our Creole Cuban sandwich and pair it with a bowl of our gumbo.
Of course, Sobu's full menu is also available.
And don't forget Sobu's version of Commander's Palace 25-cent martinis.
Available Monday through Friday, 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m.
Join us at Sobu for our speedy lunch at 310 Charter Street in the Quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Sobu, life is meant to be lived, not endured.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe, named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner. The Black Duck features over 120 rums, as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bajot heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
Every afternoon when I wake up, I say a little prayer and drink up.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Well, we're here on a Tuesday here at the Bakery Bar, as we are once a month, and we're doing our regular little visit here, service industry brunch going on, lots of friends who work in the service industry, and we, as we usually do, we kick off this series of segments. Jeff Schwartz, General Manager of Bakery Bar, here.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for coming by yet one more time.
Always a pleasure, Jeff. Once a month, as long as you'll have me stop by.
Yeah, in perpetuity.
Great. Thank you. I appreciate that. And actually, I wanted to point out, just because I know this is one of our mutual favorite words here, because I am one this morning, I started out my day with a suffering bastard.
Oh, yes. True. It's that's literally what it's for.
Yes. Thank you.
There you go. You picked the right medicine for your illness.
Exactly. Here on a Tuesday morning, I needed. I was suffering, and I have been called a bastard in times past, even as recently as probably yesterday.
Well, there you go. It's real easy.
So how are you, man? How are things going?
Pretty good. I think I had it on my mind already that, you know, we're kind of on the cusp of a new season. Spring is coming to an end. Poisonous caterpillars are falling out of the trees, apparently turning up in the middle of the dining room here.
That was an amazing thing. You just took it, just so people know, we're kind of joking about this, but we have these poisonous caterpillars that are in the trees this time of the year, mm-hmm. and they sometimes will fall out of the trees and onto you, and they sting or they bite, right?
Yeah.
And this one, though, made it to the floor of the restaurant, but on the upper level of the dining area. So not only did it get inside, but it actually climbed some stairs.
I assume that's the only way, unless it is some kind of hitchhiker, you know, on the back of someone's shirt or something like that. But
now you scare me, because I was the only person up here setting up, so maybe I brought it in.
Maybe you were in danger of stinging all along.
Thank you for saving me, Jeff.
It's true.
Or I apologize for bringing in the caterpillar, whichever one it was.
We need rigorous vetting of caterpillars.
We need extreme caterpillar vetting here on the NOLA Drink Show, yes.
It's true. But, you know, it's about to be real hot. I always say that Jazz Fest is kind of the start of summer, as far as I'm concerned, because, you know, one weekend is going to be blistering hot and people walking around like burned lobsters around the city, and then the other weekend is going to be torrential downpour.
Yeah.
And it just turns into a bog. Maybe it's not per se the technical start of summer, but I think it's when everyone experiences summer starting at the same time, because everyone's outside together just getting wrecked by New Orleans summer.
Yeah, you know, it's funny you say that, because Jazz Fest, if you're not from here, you're listening to the podcast, it's generally the last weekend of April and then the first weekend of May. Mm-hmm. And in this year, if I'm not mistaken, it's a little early, because I think Sunday is May 1st. So it's actually something like, what is it, the 22nd and 23rd and 30th and 1st or something like that?
Some tricksy thing going on.
Yeah. Oh, we got a birthday going on here at Bakery Bar. So yeah, with Jazz Fest, and then it does, you're exactly right. It's one weekend is always sweltering. and humid because we've got this that summer weather as you're talking about, and then one weekend is torrential downpour where if you don't have shrimp boots and you're out at the Orleans Parish Fairgrounds, you're really sorry that you don't have your shrimp boots.
Yeah, it's pretty rough. And so, you know, with that, I think a lot of it's we're going to see a lot of bars doing their kicking over their cocktail menus for new season. You know, you want to be serving the right drinks at the right time.
Yeah, and we touched on that a little bit last time, but what do you, and I know you mentioned a few specifics, but what do you guys have cooked up here at Bakery Bar for the spring/summer? We didn't really get a spring,
yeah.
So it's really kind of summer already. Yeah, it's getting there.
Yeah. So we're let's see here. We're most of the way there. I'd say we're about 75% done with the menu. We're bringing back some of the things that we did well last year. We're going to be doing the Raffignac.
Tell people what that is, because that's a great classic drink, and I think it's kind of almost went away, and people don't really know what it is.
For sure. So we run a half of our menu here. We run classics. I like to give some extra special love to New Orleans classics, especially those that say aren't fully canonized yet, like the frozen Irish coffee,
mm-hmm.
And ones that are a little less well known. The Raffignac has got a really interesting story in that. So it's named after, I think it's maybe the 10th mayor of New Orleans, who was like a French aristocrat who like escaped to America. And so it's cognac, raspberry shrub, and soda water. And it's a very, it's honestly a very simple drink overall.
So it's raspberry shrub, not raspberry syrup, right?
Yes, it's raspberry shrub, which is actually kind of something we sort of rediscovered as a bartending community recently, because the recipes were written calling for himbeerig. You know, that's not a word in English at all. So there's most people took it to be raspberry shrub. It's, Himbeer is German for raspberry, they would take it as raspberry syrup. And it made just kind of like this cloying drink because it's just cognac and syrup and soda water. So it's not that great. And I don't recall who finally cracked it, but someone finally realized that what they had meant in the recipe is Himbeer Essig, which is raspberry vinegar in German. That makes it a beautiful, lovely drink. I think it's very surprising that, coming back to it with the modern palate, is that it's very vibrant and flavorful. It's tart. And I think we kind of all get in a mind that, you know, the past was sepia-toned and everything tastes kind of brown. But it's a really vibrant drink, and I think it helps provide a window on, you know, what people were like in the past. It turns out, like, maybe they were just like us. Maybe they were just people.
Yeah, right. And that's a great point. It's interesting because I have heard that before. I haven't heard the shrub part before and the proper translation. Mm-hmm. What I have heard is people trying to figure out why did all these older drinks, like 19th century drinks, mm-hmm. have... everything has like raspberry syrup.
Yeah.
And in this case, obviously, that's not what we're talking about. And even I'm kind of guessing that raspberry syrup, or the term, not syrup in this case, but shrub, as you're saying, was probably even kind of generic, meaning you can't necessarily get raspberries everywhere. So it's sort of whatever berry you can get your hands on and make shrub out of it. And there you go.
Certainly. I think they're very practical about that. You know, this is before interstates and, sort of national level commerce being dependable. So you'll see a lot in older cocktail books where they're just where the garnish is like garnish with berries in season. It's like whatever berries, whatever season you got,
wherever
just
you are. Yeah, yeah.
So you know, it's easier to transmit information than produce. I would not be surprised if a lot of these sort of raspberry syrup was sort of taken as like, well, use what you got.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. That's really cool. So when is that making its debut on the menu?
I would say we're maybe 2 weeks out. We are able to do it at pretty much any time. So that's one thing that's important to me, is being able to serve drinks that we have had on previous menus. People get attached.
So, a repertoire, as you said, in times past.
You build your library. Now, I suppose that's true for maybe like 90% of our drinks. There are a few that like we just can't keep up with all that stuff.
Yeah,
but
sure.
We're maybe 2 weeks out at the most.
Okay.
So, Coming soon.
I may have to try one before I leave here today, if that's okay. Get a little sneak preview.
We'll mix one up for you.
Oh, awesome. Cool. Well, Jeff, do me a favor. We got about 30 seconds left here in this segment. Tell people, as always, where are you here at Bakery Bar? How do they find you? How do they find you and the Ruffignac?
We are Bakery Bar. We're at 1179 Annunciation. Yes, the old Italian restaurant place. So we're here in the lower Garden District.
Down in the LLG.
Yeah. We're right next to 90 and Calliope. So we're on Annunciation between Calliope and Arado. We serve cake and cocktails, and we just make your dreams come true.
Awesome. It's a great place. Come get Debbie Does Dobage, the famous Dobage here. Great drinks. Jeff runs the show here, runs the bar here. Jeff, thanks so much for having us again this month, buddy.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And I will see you, or I'll probably talk to you. Well, I'll certainly be talking to you in just a second, but we're going to take a little break here on the Nola Drink Show. Friends, come on back.
Market offers daily entertainment and delicious food and drink options throughout our 6-block district. Whether you crave raw oysters or fresh produce, authentic confections or healthy daiquiris, you can find it here. Sit at one of our cafes and hear live local music. Enjoy a muffaletta, po' boy, salad, or cheese plate in the farmers market. Check out our pop-up farmers markets on Wednesdays and Saturdays for even more fresh food options. History is being made fresh daily at the French Market. Visit frenchmarket.org for food, drink, retail, and event listings.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with Sazerac Rye Whiskey. It's football and festival season, and there's no better way to enjoy Sazerac Rye than in a pothole cocktail. Just fill up a glass with ice and your favorite root beer, and add 2 ounces of Sazerac Rye for a truly tasty toddy. Named after the city's most iconic of inconveniences, the pothole is proof that New Orleans never takes itself too seriously. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
This is Christopher Icaza, general manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucouleurs. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's grand dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon dining room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hello, this is Ron Bartholomew, and to my great city of New Orleans, I'd like to introduce to you Touch Vodka. This artisan handcrafted ultra-premium vodka is uniquely distilled from Florida's finest wildflower honey and American grain. Touch also produces key lime, Valencia orange, and ruby red grapefruit selections that are infused with natural oils of locally sourced fruit, which results in a unique 80-proof vodka with no sugar added or coloring. Touch is now available at Doranax, Cello's, and the Corporation Grill & Bar, and many other locations across Louisiana. This holiday season, sit back and relax and enjoy Touch Vodka.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. Want a great alternative to Over Oak Chardonnay? Try Yamhill Valley Vineyards Pinot Blanc, a wonderfully balanced white wine from the oldest family estate in McMinnville, Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. It's round and ripe like a Chardonnay, but without the heavy oak and sweetness of big commercial corporate Chardonnays. Yamhill Valley Vineyard Pinot Blanc, a great value under $20. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
Go down by the cow with it. Give it to him. Holly golly. Jump. Give it to him. Give it to him.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the Noel Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you, and we are at Bakery Bar, as you know, as we do once a month or so here. Come out and hang out and talk with friends here in the service industry, and sort of a bittersweet show here. My good friend Basil Zirinsky, you're leaving us.
Yes, I'm leaving in 2 days.
Yes, and you're about to engage in a really exciting adventure. You're going to go and you're moving to Greece.
Yes, I'm moving to Athens.
That is really neat. Now, you have been there before.
Yes, I have. I've been kind of obsessed with it for a while. I completely fell in love with it and wanted to move there for a while. It's definitely my favorite city I've been to in Europe. So I'm really excited to try and actually make this a reality.
So you went there, it was last year, right?
It was almost 2 years ago now.
Almost 2 years ago. Okay, I remember when you went on that trip. And so you're going to go there and you're going to look around. You have some connections there and stuff. And you're looking to make a move. You want to get behind the bar there in Athens somewhere.
Yeah, the goal is to spend these next few months trying to get a work visa or residency permit and make it a permanent move.
That's really exciting. Now, you and I have known, I want to, and this is sort of part of the purpose here, because you and I have known each other for a number of years now. And
I think most of my time in New Orleans.
Yeah, and actually a significant chunk of my time in New Orleans, at least as a permanent resident here. And you and I met going back to, I think it was at a wine tasting that I was putting on at a hotel
yes.
in the French Quarter a while ago. And we just became friends that way. And then you were at that time working at Bartonique, and we've been friends ever since.
You've been one of the few regulars that has followed me through multiple bars.
I have been to every one of your establishments that you've worked at. You make great drinks. You're a good person, and I've always had a laugh. So I'm definitely going to miss you, Basil. I mean, you know,
I'm going to miss you too. Come visit me in Greece.
I will certainly do that. So it's really exciting. And so now, and you've worked hard at your craft, and I think we know, we talk about this a lot on this show, that people that work in the bar industry here in New Orleans, especially at the nice establishments, and when I say nice, I mean pro establishments, we're talking about professional bartending, and you are certainly one of those. You're actually one of the best bartenders I know in the city.
Oh, thank you so much.
Absolutely. Oh, it's very true, and you've made some really great drinks for me, and actually, I always bring this one up, and I'm going to bring it up anyway because, well, I'm going to. So you made this drink when you were at Bartonique, I think, and you swapped out the liquor, but it was called the St. Anne's Tango.
St. Anne's Tango, yeah. Yes. And I believe I can't make any promises, but I have been told that they might be putting it back on the menu at some point.
Oh, really?
Or at least on, like, a special seasonal menu. I think they might be bringing back some of the, like, old drinks that used to be on the menu that have been kind of favorites among the years. So,
excuse me. That's really neat. And let's tell people what was in that drink, just because it's really cool. It's very unique.
Yes, that was mezcal, averna, fresh strawberry, fresh basil, the Bitterman's Hellfire Shrub, and just a little bit of fresh lemon.
Yeah, and a nice bit of lime a mint for a garnish.
It's a basil for the garnish.
Oh, that's right. Okay. So, I mean, makes sense. It's a really neat drink because it has spice, the mezcal note. Now, I think if I remember right, when you originally made that drink, you had entered it in a cocktail competition and the base spirit was different. Is that right?
Yes. It was for a competition for Reka Vodka to go to Tales on Tour in Argentina. So the cocktail competition, they kind of wanted us to combine flavors of New Orleans with flavors of South America. So that's kind of where the name comes from. We're on St. Anne Street in New Orleans, mm-hmm. Tango, Argentina, but the tango was spelt in the New Orleans style.
E-A-U at the end.
E-A-U-X. E-A-U-X.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Amaro, specifically Fernet, is very popular in Argentina. And I originally tried to incorporate that, but the Averna just played better with the other flavors. And then strawberries are very local Louisiana produce, so it's kind of where the inspiration came from. But then once the competition was over, I decided it tasted better with mezcal because, as many people know, agave is my first love in the spirits world.
Yeah, so. Well, let's elaborate on that a little. And then I think that's how you hooked me into the drink. I never tried the vodka version, which, not putting that down, I'm sure it was a great drink, but the mezcal version,
for a vodka
it spoke
drink,
to my
it was,
soul.
It was very good.
I bet. But the mezcal version, I'm just going to guess, is a little better. The smokiness on the mezcal is fantastic.
Oh, yeah. The smokiness definitely adds another layer of depth, I think.
Well, let's back up a little bit, Basil. Let's talk about where you're from. Let's talk about how you ended up in New Orleans.
So I was born in New York, raised mostly in New Mexico. My upbringing was very strange. I was raised in a Sikh community. I ended up going to school in Amritsar in North India when I was 15, lived there for a year. I had kind of an unusual upbringing, had raised on unusual foods, which I think is what kind of drew me to bartending and working with flavors. Then from there, I started bartending in San Francisco, where I went pretty much right after high school. And then ended up coming
how
here
long,
after that.
And how long ago was that? When did you move to San Francisco?
I moved to San Francisco in 2003.
Okay. And how long were you in San Francisco?
I was there till 2008.
Okay.
So about 5 years.
See, and these are some of the things that I think why you and I are friends is because growing up in California, and I grew up in the Bay Area by San Francisco, so we had that in common. And then love of food, and we've had interesting conversations about Mexican food, like New Mexico Mexican food and some of these other things, and griping about the situation with Mexican food here in New Orleans.
I'm still curious about that place that calls itself a new Mexican restaurant on the North Shore, by the way.
Yeah, it's right across the street from where we live. And strangely, Basil, actually, we've never been there because everything I hear about it's not great.
I'm sure it's terrible, but there's still a little part of me that kind of wants to go.
Well, you know what? Here's what I'll do. We'll get over there and try it, and then I'll give you a report.
All right.
How's that?
Sounds good.
At least you get a little bit of closure on that vicariously. So, and then also when you were in San Francisco, you did some DJing, right?
I did DJing. I did a lot of work in the music industry. So I was booking live shows. I managed a band for a while. I did a lot of photography for bands, both live shows and promotional, and then just a lot of event promotion. But yeah, DJing was definitely probably the biggest part of that. I ended up actually building a fairly decent name for myself in that category, in the tiny little sub scene of music that I was in.
Right, I still call it the city because I grew up there by San Francisco. And I think that's another thing that we have in common, actually, is that I'm quite a ways older than you, so a lot of these bands that you used to like to play were bands that I actually saw when I was in high school. And
yeah,
other
well,
things.
I started doing 80s new wave, so probably.
That music, yeah, right there. That's what I'm talking about. We're going to move on from that real quickly. Well, actually, you know, let's do this, Basil. We're going to take a little bit of a break here on the show. I'm going to come back. Let's do another segment because I want to talk a little bit more about your time in New Orleans and what you did here. And then let's talk a little bit about what we're drinking, which is really cool. Thank you for sharing that. We'll get to that. And then we'll talk a little bit about what you're going to be looking to do a little further in Greece there. Sound good? Folks, awesome. Thank you. Folks, we're chatting with my good friend Basil Zirinsky, who is going to be leaving us in a couple days. Actually, by the time you're hearing this, you might even be hearing this while she's sitting on an airplane. So we're going to get a little bit more of her scoop when we come on back. Friends, come on back to the Nola Drink Show. We'll be right back.
I've got my suitcase in my hand.
Hey, ladies. Are you looking for wine to bring to your next girls' night out? Grab a bottle of Capitello wines and enjoy the taste of fruit from Oregon's Willamette Valley. Capitello has a wide variety of wines to choose from. Sauvignon Blanc, Pinot Noir, dessert wine, and a Brut Sparkling that's a blend of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay. He'll even stop by next time he's in town. So grab the girls, have fun, and enjoy Capitello wine. Cheers.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in the Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Locally inspired and nationally recognized, Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse serves USDA prime beef, Gulf seafood, and innovative Creole dishes. Come experience why Maxim Magazine and Playboy named it among the nation's top steakhouses. Running short on time? The full menu is available in the bar for quicker and more casual dining. Dickie Brennan's 5 After 5 Happy Hour Special is back. Dickie Brennan Steakhouse is located in the French Quarter at 716 Iberville.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Gould is here with you. We're here at Bakery Bar, as you know, and as you probably know, chatting with my good friend Basil Zerinsky. And Basil has been one of my good friends here in New Orleans for a number of years. We kind of came to town permanently right around the same time. I think I was here a couple years before, maybe, but not by a lot. Yep.
Yeah. I think I came here in 2011.
Yeah. So. Yeah, and I think I moved here 2008, 2009, kind of that range as a full-timer. And we've known each other for a long time, and you're getting ready to move to Greece, which is exciting. And in the spirit of that, you've brought us something very interesting that we're tasting here.
Yeah, I brought a bottle. It's the last bottle of a Greek liquor that I have left at my house. I've been trying to get rid of my liquor collection. But I bought this in Athens. It's the Metaxa. It's the 15-year-old Metaxa. It comes in a really beautiful ceramic hand-painted bottle. For those not familiar, Metaxa is a Greek brandy. It has been slightly sweetened with a Muscat wine and flavored with different like herbs and flowers. The recipe is super secret, but there's definitely some rose petal in there.
Yeah, we were talking about that when we were sipping it at the very beginning. So their secret about it, as you said, and I can get that floral from the rose petal. And I'm also sipping on the Ruffignac that we were discussing with Jeff a couple segments back. So there's raspberry shrub in that. However, I do get a berry kind of fruit note.
Yeah, I taste it too. I don't know if it's just because you suggested it.
It's the power of suggestion.
The power of suggestion is real.
It's very strong, exactly.
But I definitely, like, on the finish, I can see a little bit of a raspberry flavor to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really nice. Thanks for sharing that.
You're welcome.
So we were talking a little bit about your background and how you ended up here. So you moved here in 2011 from San Francisco. And so how long had you, so did you start immediately working behind the bar in San Francisco?
No, I actually worked at a record store when I first moved there.
Oh, which one? I didn't know that. Which one?
Yeah, Rasputin on Powell.
Oh, yeah, I know that. I spent a lot of money in that store.
That was the worst job I have ever had.
You know, you're not.
I think my brain, I really like kind of romanticized working in a record store. I think I thought it would be like high fidelity. It was not.
No.
It was
no.
Miserable.
You know what? It's funny you say this, Basil, because I worked in high school at Rainbow Records. And mm-hmm. Actually, first I worked at Record Factory, which is a small chain in the Bay Area that went out of business in 88. And even people like at the time that worked for Rasputin's, they were not fans of working for Rasputin's. And it was a small community of people that worked in Record
Factory. The owner is a crazy person.
Absolutely. Yeah.
He didn't care about music at all. He had a dream that Rasputin came to him and told him he would make lots of money selling round discs. So he opened a pizza place and a record store.
Yeah, and he, you know, the one, and here's the weird thing, and I don't want to go too far down this tangent, but I used to go to the one in Berkeley. And when I was a kid, I, you know, get on the we call it BART, but it was the subway, the metro.
I think that was the first location.
That was the first location. And they were actually on Telegraph at the time before they moved around the corner. But anyway, and you walk in there, and I'm 12 or 13, you know, you can still, my parents would let me get on the train with two of my friends and go up there and go in to buy records. And, like, you'd walk in to Rasputin's, and that was when the owner was in there. And the dude's, like, they've got the little pull-down screens with the projectors playing movies. Uh-huh. Dude's, like, playing porn flicks and stuff like that in the record store.
It does not surprise me.
Yeah, it was an interesting place.
Yeah, Amoeba, which is a much better record store, in my opinion, was actually opened by a bunch of disgruntled Rasputin's employees. People.
Yep, I remember that, too. Yeah, again, very small community there in the record community. But anyway, so we were talking. We ended up here in New Orleans, and so you started out. You worked at a record store, then got behind the bar in San Francisco. Let's jump here. So when you got, what prompted you to move to New Orleans?
So a friend of mine, who's actually the singer of the band I used to manage, had been obsessed with New Orleans, and he really wanted to move here. And I had wanted to leave San Francisco, so we had talked about moving here many times, and actually got to the point where we were planning on doing it. And so I had moved out of my apartment in San Francisco. I'd put all my stuff in storage. I was ready to go. And then he kept pushing back the move date. And, like, you know, 1 month went by, and then another month went by, and I'm staying at friends' houses on their couches. And, like, I can't do this anymore. I need to either get another place in San Francisco or I need to go somewhere. And so my brother called me, like, that week and told me he needed a roommate in Albuquerque, and I didn't really have any desire to live in Albuquerque, but I was like, oh, Albuquerque's really cheap, right? Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, we can get a place for this much. I'm like, all right, I'll be there in a week. So the whole plan was to move to Albuquerque just for a year or two to save money to go somewhere I actually wanted to be. And kind of that, like, romanticized version of New Orleans that my friend had talked about kind of stayed in my head that whole time. And so I finally ended up coming out to visit while I was living in Albuquerque, and it was everything I thought it would be and more. So I was like, all right, that's still the goal. I'm going to move to New Orleans. I set a budget for myself. I'm like, once I have this amount of money, I'll move. And so I did.
Cool. And so, did you know anybody here at the time? Or did you?
No.
No. So you just came in and you just clicked with the city then?
No. Yeah. Actually, I ended up, like, the bartending community here was so welcoming. I ended up making a really solid group of friends super fast.
Yeah, and it's a very welcoming group that way. And so, was Tonique your first bar? Tonique your first job?
No, I was at the Sazerac Bar.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that. Okay,
for
yeah.
For about 9 months, it was not a good fit for me.
Yeah, that's.
But I used to hang out in Tonique all the time, even before I got the job at Sazerac. I'd sit in there on my computer, house hunting and job hunting, to the point that Ed Diaz came up to me and was like, you basically just live here. Like, well, I figure if I sit here long enough, eventually you'll offer me a job.
So Ed is the
took
proprietor.
Took a couple
of
years, but he finally did.
Well, and I'm sure you probably sat in there for a year before he even spoke a word to you, right? You
know? Oh, yeah. Ed only speaks when he's had a few drinks in it.
Exactly. That there's Ed Diaz for you. So that's right. I forgot you were. So for listeners who don't know, so the Sazerac Bar is in the Roosevelt Hotel, and it's kind of a famous bar in the hotel, sort of. White glove type place.
It's a beautiful place.
It is.
But it's very corporate.
Right. And so there you go. And Bar Tonique is very not.
Yes.
We'll just put it that way.
Bar Tonique, we kind of consider the neighborhood dive bar of cocktail bars. It's very laid back. It's very fun. It's a service industry hangout.
Yep. Yeah.
Like polar opposite.
It is the polar opposite. And it's a cool place too, because, and we've talked about Bar Tonique with different people, it's sort of the alumni base, if you will, that has come out of Bar Tonique.
Yes.
People, a lot of people that are sitting at the bar over here at Bakery Bar right now are alumni from Bar Tonique. So it is kind of a neighborhood bar, kind of divey, but it's one of the best craft cocktail bars, I would say, anywhere, but certainly in New Orleans.
Yeah, and it was actually the first standalone cocktail bar to open in the city post Katrina.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Right there on Rampart
Opened
Street.
Opened like 6 months before Cure.
Yeah, there you go. Let's get that in there. Well, Basil, we got about a minute and a half or so, 2 minutes left. So you're moving to Greece. You're moving to Athens. You're going to you want to get behind the bar there. You went out and visited. You've got some connections, though, right? I mean, you've got some opportunity.
I do. I know I met a lot of bartenders there when I was there. There is also a bartender that was a cap at Tales of the Cocktail who's been kind enough to rent me an apartment while I'm there. So hopefully between all the people I've met, we can work something out and find me a job.
That's cool. That's really, really exciting. I'm really happy for you that you're making this move. It's a good thing. I want to come visit.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, so
they've got one of the best cocktail scenes in the world right now.
I'm there.
It's amazing.
And I got a good pal going there, so there you go. Basil, thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate it. I'm going to miss you. I said that before, but say it again.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Friends, come on back to the NOLA Drink Show. Friend Basil Zirinsky here, and safe travels to her. We're going to be right back. We're going to talk with, I don't know, somebody else. Come on back.
Shake things up or find the bartender in you? We mean literally. At the New Orleans Drink Lab, you'll do just that. We teach you the history and tradition of classic New Orleans cocktails. Then you get behind the bar and make them. Master classes are fun, interactive, and hands-on. Great for small groups and team building. Come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. You mix, muddle, and master the art of cocktail making. Visit us at 343 Barone Street. Or go to our website, drinklabnola.com.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region, producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood, or our bold, rich Petite Sirah, excellent with steak, to our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
With the season's beautiful weather, it's a perfect time to take a drive across Lake Pontchartrain and visit New Orleans' only local vineyard and winery, Pontchartrain Vineyards. Our tasting room is open Wednesday through Sunday from noon till 4, or by appointment. Come enjoy a flight of our wines in our classically styled French Provençal tasting room, or pack a picnic lunch and enjoy a bottle of wine on our patio overlooking the vineyard. While you're there, ask about our wine club. For more information, go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Hi, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy, suggesting that great handcrafted Pinot Noir from Oregon doesn't need to be expensive. Consider Yamhill Valley Vineyard Estate Pinot Noir from the oldest family estate in the Willamette Valley of Oregon. It's rich, ripe, wonderfully balanced, and it's only about $20 at your favorite New Orleans wine shop. Yamhill Valley Vineyard. Top quality doesn't need to be expensive if you know what to drink. Ask for it wherever you buy wine. Cheers.
The best in wining and dining daily. It's the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show with Tim McNally from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. on WGSO 990 AM New Orleans.
Tim McNally, welcome to the Dine, Wine, and Spirit Show, NOLA Drinks Edition. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the NOLA Drinks Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Happy to be here with you. Happy to be here at Bakery Bar. Happy to be here with my friend, once again, Jeff Schwartz, general manager here.
Oh, hello.
Hey, welcome back, Jeff.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the Ruffignac that you made for me was very nice. I sipped on that just a little while ago throughout.
Yeah, the past is in color. It's hard to believe sometimes, but like, yeah, not everything's brown and gray, especially not flavor wise.
I think everybody has dreamt in color for a long time.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like that old Eddie Murphy line, right? That I dream in black and white, and I didn't know it was lime Jello until I bit into it. I'm paraphrasing greatly, but anyway.
I assume.
Yes, yes. So it was nice with the raspberry shrub and a classic cocktail, and we have a lot of, you know, in the canon of New Orleans and in other places, obviously a lot of classic cocktails, a lot of new cocktails, and I think what we're talking about, you know, we're talking about flavor profiles here.
Yeah.
And I think with, you know, some of the classic cocktails obviously have beautiful, well-established flavor profiles. Some of the creative stuff that people come up with, fresh ingredients, some new things, allow us to do things. And one of the things that might allow us to do that you and I were just talking about before coming back here on the air was you may associate this more with wine, but pairing cocktails, and a lot of you know this too, pairing cocktails with food is a very viable thing to do.
Oh, sure. I would say that it might be more difficult than wine or beer, even. I think that partially can come down to an ABV situation. If you're serving, you know, five stiff drinks, you know, even with a five-course meal, your guests might become quite drunk.
Yeah.
So I think it can take a lighter touch than wine pairing. You have to be very careful and definitely think about it holistically throughout the meal. But I think there's a lot of opportunity there, too, because you can engineer a perfect pairing, whereas with wine or beer, you have to sort of seek out the thing you want to pair with your food. And it's not always, it can take some sort of push and pull on both ends to make those things go together. With cocktails, you know, you have the world at your fingertips, and you can make a drink taste exactly how you want it to, with enough iteration and diligence.
Yeah, and and using, for example, I think one of the things we see, and I want to back up to your first point in a second, but one of the things, you know, we certainly see is when you're, say, working in a restaurant setting where you have seasonal ingredients, you know, produce, whatever we're talking about, integrating that into a cocktail program is... some people may not think about that. I mean, it's kind of the norm in a lot of situations, but this is sort of what we're talking about is, hey, kitchen working with bar, these things are seasonal, and maybe it's just people might perceive it because it's one of these things, well, I can get strawberries, so I'm using behind the bar, using them in the kitchen, taking that next step of saying, this dish that I prepare and this drink I put on the menu, utilizing strawberries, let's take that next step and put them together.
Yeah, certainly. I think... working hand in hand with the kitchen is a great way to make that happen. I think it does require like a lot of coordination. I think a lot of the times, you know, both parties are sort of tinkering away in their labs separately, and then kind of post facto, you have to say, well, hey, does this go with this? Do these work together? And right. it can become a little bit of like a wine pairing situation where, you know, the whoever's writing the cocktail menu, you know, puts all these cocktails out, and then whoever's writing the dinner menu, you know, just puts those dishes out there, and it can be a little bit of like having to do wine pairing is like, okay, well, this will kind of work with this, and
there has to be that next step, right? And I think, this is sort of what we're talking about, is that you may get, and maybe I didn't state it well enough, but okay, whatever fresh produce is available, mm-hmm. and it's being utilized behind the bar, and it's being utilized in the kitchen, and that's great, and you're both using it because it's available right now, everybody's creative, it's on the cocktail list, it's on the dinner list, but taking that next step and having a conversation between the kitchen and the bar where something's not flowing downhill one or the other, it's how do we make something like this dish and this mm-hmm. cocktail, you give your servers some power to recommend some things as well.
Yeah, yeah. I will say it can be tough sells for people. So one thing I've done before at Coquette, you know, we were doing, I was given a lot of freedom to sort of write the pairings for the dessert menu, which I think is a great place to get people on cocktail pairings, because I think desserts tend to be, I hesitate to say one note, but maybe like more focused than say, I don't know, a fish dish with vegetables and broth, and you have all these, like almost like the, you know, a... like a dish can very much be sort of these combination of flavors working together, much like a cocktail is.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas frequently desserts tend to be a little more intense. And, you know, you're having chocolate cake, and, like, that's what it is. It's chocolate cake. It's not chocolate cake with this and this and this. And
right.
This. So I think it's easier to find sort of a harmony and counterpoint as opposed to two, you know, complete flavors next to each other, just kind of just touching, you know. It's not
right.
Quite the... what I'm getting at is that, like, pairing with food can be really hard with cocktails. I think the most success I've seen with it is Cole Newton did a pairing dinner utilizing beer cocktails.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of those ways to sort of make that a little easier, is, you know, have a lower ABV because half of your drink is beer as opposed to spirit and spirit and spirit.
You know, and that's something I wanted to... What I said earlier, circling back on your first point there, is talking about the alcohol level, the volume of alcohol that a patron is ingesting with the food. And having dealt with this a lot in the world of wine, you kind of have a couple choices. Okay, so, you know, if I'm going to do a 6-course or 5-course wine pairing, I'm probably not going to do 6 6-ounce pours.
For
a full
instance,
glass of wine.
Yeah.
So exactly. So, you know, you choose the number of beverages and dishes. Mm-hmm. Or you choose the volume of the cocktail. And obviously cocktails can be scaled that way too, right?
Yeah, certainly. I think that's an important tool to also use. Like, you know, you can do, you know, maybe for a later course, you know, it's a little 1-ounce pour of something.
Yeah, absolutely. And you don't need
it,
and especially
nice and easy.
Yeah, and if you're doing, like, what we were talking about, too, before we went on the air, the idea where you're doing a particular type of pairing where it's not meant to be a sit-down, full-course meal, mm-hmm. but you're doing 5 small plates, you don't necessarily need a cocktail that's going to be lower ABV, maybe more juice, maybe more whatever, soda water, something in it. Mm-hmm. You know, people don't need to be getting 7, 6, 7, 8 ounces of liquid. You can do that version and cut it in half where they're getting 3 or 4 ounces of liquid and make that drink to scale.
Yeah, portioning can be a great tool here.
Portion control. Isn't that the term that people use?
Yeah, portion control.
Portion control. And it is very interesting, and I know that people probably think, well, of course, duh. You know, people pair wine with food. We all know that. We don't need to go down that road. And more common we see these days are mm-hmm. as you said, Jeff, before we went on the air, beer pairing food opportunities, dinners, and tasting mm-hmm. things. And the cocktail thing, I think, is really, it's fascinating. It seems to be something that is kind of, I mean, it's always been there to a certain
mm-hmm.
degree.
Yeah.
You know, so like pairing different bourbons with things and things like that. But
sure.
Taking that next step to pair a cocktail that's been crafted with multi-ingredients with a dish with multi-ingredients.
Yeah. You get a lot of opportunity. You know, you were talking about doing seasonal produce, and that can be a great way to sort of find harmony between your drink and the dish. I think you know, you can also take those opportunities to, you know, find a, you know, focus on a really great counterpoint, you know, like have some sort of very apple-y tasting cocktail with, say, a pork chop or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think there's a real breadth out there that I wish I saw more of. You know, one of my sort of favorite service industry moments for myself was at Coquette. We had our new pastry chef. He came in. He had dinner with his wife. He sat down at the bar, and, you know, chef was just like, I'm just going to feed him, you know, let's say 7-8 courses. And, you know, Zach just said, hey, you know, pair whatever you want. And so that was a good feeling of a sort of like expression of mastery for me. It was like, I didn't know what the food was until like 5 minutes before it came out. And you know, I just used everything at my disposal, you know, wines, beers, cocktails, you know, neat pours of spirits. Like, I would love to see a lot more of that in the world, because there's, as much as everybody loves wine, I'm kind of iffy on wine, whatever. It has, as wide as that palette of flavors is, it is limited, you know.
It could even be broader. And it says, let's do this. Let's take a quick break here, Jeff. Hold that thought. Let's come back
sure.
to that topic. Can you do that? All right, friends, coming back to the Noel Drink Show. We're talking about cocktail pairings with Jeff Schwartz. Come on back.
Okay.
savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
Looking for a bottle of wine to impress your friends and family? Miro Cellars from California's Russian River Valley is the perfect wine for any occasion. Miro Cellars searches the region for the finest grapes to make their one-of-a-kind specialty wines. Award-winning winemaker Miro Chelikov considers the particular geology and seasonal climate of each vineyard when selecting the most interesting grapes the region has to offer. Because Miro has complete freedom to make precisely the wines he loves best, the results are spectacular. Let yourself in on one of the best-kept secrets in wine today, Miro Cellars.
Are you looking for a great place to enjoy great handcrafted and vintage cocktails? Victory is located at 339 Barone Street in the heart of downtown New Orleans. We have a variety of spirits, a talented team of bartenders, and great gourmet small plates. Our mission? To preserve an era when cocktails were made with artistry and pride. Grab your friends and come enjoy the ultimate cocktail experience. Give us a call to book your next private event or go to our website, victorynola.com. See you soon. Cheers.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Nola Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. We're hanging out with Jeff Schwartz here at Bakery Bar, as we do once a month at Bakery Bar, and with Jeff Schwartz, who is the general manager here. And we were sort of waxing philosophical a little bit before the break here on cocktail pairings and kind of cocktail pairings being maybe by some people, not everybody, but misperceived that they're not quite as obvious, I guess I'll say, as wine pairings, which I think we probably all know, wine and food, and then beer pairings also too, probably number two on the depth chart that you may know or have some familiarity with. And then now cocktail pairings kind of starting to get a little bit of their own glow and recognition.
It's true, yeah. Well, you know, I feel like they each have their own strengths. You know, I think a lot of us are familiar with, you know, what wine is capable of. You know, you can get earthy notes, spice notes like pepper, berries, stone fruit, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Over the break, you're saying wine can be very subtle, and sometimes you almost have to sort of like hold the picture in your mind to sort of like feel the pairing just right. You know it.
Yeah, and I was gonna say, Jeff. I mean, just to elaborate on that point a little bit, we were talking about during the break, and a bit of my background is wine education and wine tasting and teaching people sensory perception of wines and these sorts of things. I've done that for a long time, and as you just said, the idea that, you know, it might be a little more subtle and certainly maybe even more subjective. There's biological wiring, of course, we don't need to. That's a topic for another show. But the idea of being able to pick out the specific flavor notes and profiles in a wine mm-hmm. is not quite as obvious. I mean, there's maybe an advantage here, I guess, is where I'm going with doing cocktails, yeah. is that I don't have to kind of tell you I'm getting notes of strawberry. And you either have to believe me or you have to get it or have the experience to be mm-hmm. able to pick these flavors out, whereas maybe in a cocktail you can just say, dude, I put strawberry shrub in the cocktail like the Ruffignac you made me earlier.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, I think cocktails have a huge advantage there. Like I said, you know, you can engineer it. And for me, a goal that I frequently have with cocktails is, you know, if I'm finding myself getting close to, say, a familiar flavor profile, like, let's say, a York peppermint patty. For instance,
yeah, okay.
I like to just kind of hone and sharpen that edge till it's almost like when you taste it, it's like the platonic ideal of a York peppermint patty. Maybe it's better, you know, or like recreating taste from childhood. For instance, like Luxardo cherries, those beautiful yep. Luxardo cherries. They're, you know, in that deep dark syrup, and you take a bite, and it's just like fruit exploding in your mouth. And like I always, you know. I make sure my guests eat those because, like, it's not a regular old maraschino cherry. It's, for me, I say it's like how your child brain remembers Gushers tasting.
Yeah. You know, this is a really silly tangent, but I know you'll appreciate it given the point that you just made. So I used to love the cheap, glowing, nuclear red maraschino cherries, right?
Oh,
so
yeah.
Go out and get an ice cream sundae on your birthday, whatever. And there was always a funky smell. And there was a funky smell that I, I still loved them, but there was some sort of funky smell that I could never get past. And then when I was in fifth or sixth grade and we dissected a frog, and the frog was actually preserved in formaldehyde.
Aha!
And there was that smell, because maraschino cherries have the formaldehyde on them, and I could never, ever get past that again. And the Luxardo cherries, that's like the true deal, but you're talking about childhood memories and these things that we sort of hold on to, and those maraschino cherries, they have formaldehyde on them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, if you can't get past it, but engineering, as you said, those, maybe not the formaldehyde flavor, but as you said, the ideal or sharpen, I like your term, of a York peppermint patty. So it's not necessarily going down the road of like sort of the slightly cheaper chocolate and the fake peppermint. It's like real chocolate and peppermint, how that really works and why, I think, right?
Yeah, exactly. The sort of, like I was saying, like a platonic ideal, or just like, you know, if it's something you hadn't had since you were a child, and then you can sort of make it almost hyper real, make it more real than that York peppermint patty ever was, but it's the same set of flavors. I think that's
like
a thing.
Real chocolate and real peppermint, as opposed to fake. Right?
Exactly. So I think that can really help give cocktails an edge when it comes to pairing. You know, we were talking about, say, pork and apple, but if you have, you know, you can get like an appley tasting sort of wine, or maybe you could serve cider, or you can like get. You can make a cocktail that tastes more like apples than apples do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like because that's the thing I like to do, sort of a layer flavors together. So, you know, you could say do an apple liqueur with fresh pressed apple cider plus some sort of apple spirit, and that's going to pick out all of these different notes of apple and bring this really fully realized apple flavor. Where you were saying, where like you don't have to say, hey, you know, this tastes like apples. You don't have to tell anybody. They just go, oh my gosh, this tastes
it
just
tastes like
biting
apple.
Into an apple.
Right.
That's a thing I really pursue in cocktails a lot. And beer's advantage when it comes to pairing is that it just draws on a different palate from wine. You know, you can get all sorts of roasted flavors, which are really almost impossible in wine. But there's so much food that we roast or brown or toast. Like, all of that's there in beer, and that's not hard to pick out.
I think the closest that you can get in wine in that is when you start to get into some red wines that'll have a leathery or saddle kind of notes, and occasionally you'll get into that sort of beef jerky note, which I know sounds weird, but I'll find that on like New World Syrahs can demonstrate that. But it's not overt, it's not toasted, it's not roasted.
One of my favorite pairings actually is with a cheese plate. I love having a Saison DuPont. Which is an old farmhouse Belgian Saison. So it's Saisons tend to be really idiosyncratic, and they reflect like what grows around that farmhouse brewery.
Often can be a little citrusy, right?
Yeah, so they tend to add, you know, whatever spices, citrus, and so on. But Saison DuPont is just dry like a cracker. Like, it's like drinking a cracker, and why wouldn't you want that with your cheese plate? I mean, ultimately, you know, cheese is just grain processed by a cow, and beer is just grain processed by yeast. You know, they grow together and they go together.
I like that. That's really good. And a good saison. I mean, we're talking about seasonal stuff. I mean, we start to get into this time of year where more saisons are on the market.
Oh yeah, they're lovely summer beers. Like I said, they tend to be really dry, and they and effervescent too. So they can be kind of a good sort of siesta type beer for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Warm day, sit outside, they're kind of refreshing. Some of them can have a little bit, maybe deceptively higher ABV than you might think, but they're not, we're not talking about barley wine or Belgian triples or something here.
Well, who hasn't been drunk on a summer afternoon before?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm looking around the room and I don't see anybody raising their hand, and I'm not raising my hand, Jeff. So yeah, absolutely. And let's coming back to the cocktail thing and pairing, so we're kind of teeing this up a little bit. Again, this is stuff that's gone on. It's not like we're reinventing the wheel here. But, you know, just for the listeners out there that maybe aren't familiar, we can do what we do with wine, and we can do what we do with beer. We can do this with cocktails. And like you just said earlier, I think one of the advantages is you can be a little bit more deliberate with cocktails and your ingredients and your food pairing. And this is something that you're starting to explore.
Oh, yes. So we've got I've got a couple things going. We're working on doing pairings with our new dessert menu. You know, at nights we've kind of pivoted away a little bit from doing basically serving people dinner. I think we're choosing to believe in ourselves and just serve more dessert. And with that, that's going to include, like, yeah, let's throw some cocktail pairings on for desserts. You know, we've got, you know, fried ham pies. I hesitate to say just like Cubics made, because I don't want to start any fights.
Right. We talked about King Cake Turf Wars in a previous show.
inspired by Cubics. And, you know, a lovely sort of Bananas Foster themed bread pudding. We do a great grasshopper pie bomb situation, and it's like eating a grasshopper cocktail. So I'd hesitate to pair a grasshopper with that, but you know, we could do something
if you like mint.
I'm working on that, and I've got the seed of an idea. We might be doing some cocktail pairing events here as well going forward. So keep your ear to the ground.
Awesome. Friends, Jeff Schwartz here, General Manager of Bakery Bar. Appreciate it, Jeff. As always, thanks for hosting. Friends, coming back to the NOLA Drink Show. We got just a little bit more to go. Come on back.
This is Christopher Icaza, General Manager of Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street in the beautiful Vaucouleurs. We encourage you to come join us this fall and experience the renovation of one of the French Quarter's grand dames. Join us in our beautifully renovated Napoleon dining room. Come see our friend Paul Gustings at the beautiful Empire Bar. Experience one of the French Quarter's loveliest courtyards. That's Broussard's Restaurant, 819 Conti Street. Open 7 nights a week and every Sunday for brunch.
Hi, this is Jeff Craner with the award-winning Nottingham Cellars, located in Livermore Valley, California's oldest wine-growing region. Producers of fine wines. Try our clean, crisp 1846 Chardonnay, an ideal pairing with New Orleans seafood. Or our bold, rich Petit Sirah, excellent with steak. To our flagship Bordeaux-style blend, Supremacy. You can find our wines in finer restaurants throughout New Orleans. Hope you enjoy our wines.
Hey, New Orleans, Jack Jelenko here, local wine guy. If you're listening to this show, you love good food and good wine. And a great wine with our plentiful, fresh Gulf seafood is the Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc, a crisp, balanced white blend from the south of France. Whether it's with fresh oysters, crab, redfish, or shrimp, this Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc will not disappoint, and it's a great value at around $14. Domaine St. Rose Coquille Blanc.
Hi, this is Kevin Richards with New Orleans' own Sazerac Company, makers of Sazerac Rye Whiskey. In case you haven't noticed, rye whiskey is hot, flying off store shelves and dominating the bar scene in New Orleans and around the country. Rye's spicy and assertive character is drawing in those looking for whiskey with a bite, but that equally pairs well with cocktails. Enjoy it in cocktails like the Old Fashioned or Manhattan, or simply savor it on the rocks. Sazerac Rye Whiskey, the way New Orleans does whiskey.
The French Market is a place where history is made fresh daily. From the historic Upper Pontalba building on Jackson Square to the ever-evolving Farmers Market, our six-block district celebrates New Orleans food, music, and culture through events, festivals, walking tours, health and fitness classes, and also children's workshops at the New Orleans Jazz Park. Visit our calendar of events at www.frenchmarket.org. The French Market, making history fun since 1791.
Are you looking for the best buns? Well, we have them at Bayou Burger in the Quarter. Wait till you bite into one of our acclaimed burgers like the Cowboy Burger, Tiebreaker Shrimp Burger, the world-famous Gator Burger, or you can build your own with endless combinations. It's all fresh meat, never ever frozen. Everywhere you look, there's big screen TVs where you'll never miss a minute of the action. Boasting the largest balcony dining in the French Quarter, you can watch all the action pass you by on the street. Find the best burgers in action at Bayou Burger. 501 Bourbon at St. Louis for the best buns on bourbon. It's Bayou Burger, baby.
Did you know that there's a vineyard and winery making quality table wines just 1 hour north of New Orleans? At Pontchartrain Vineyards, we produce award-winning wines from our 15-acre vineyard, as well as premium wine grapes sourced from the West Coast. Try our light, crisp, Louisiana-grown Blanc du Bois, or have a glass of Chardonnay, Zinfandel, or our Cab Syrah blend made right here in Louisiana. There's something for everyone at Pontchartrain Vineyards. For more information, Go to PontchartrainVineyards.com.
Savory crab meat cheesecake and decadent white chocolate bread pudding are Palace Cafe originals. For nearly 26 years, Palace Cafe has been serving award-winning cuisine in the historic Warline Music Building. Located on Canal Street at the edge of the French Quarter, Palace Cafe is open 7 days a week for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and open for jazz brunch on the weekends. Make sure to try one of their refined classic cocktails or a glass of wine from their nationally recognized wine list. Palace Cafe is located at 605 Canal Street.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. We're here at Bakery Bar, and we're wrapping this up here today. Thanks again to these guys for hosting us. Pleased to be joined by my good friend, Mark Shetler, who is the president of the New Orleans chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild, Intergalactic Overlord, as we like to say, and also general manager of Bar Tonique, but also a good dude who has been very active through the USBG as well as his own activities in engaging social issues as it relates to the service community and other ways. And one of the things that you all did on Sunday was National Tip Out Day, Mark.
Yeah, so this was one of the first program activation, whatever, that Molly Bird and I did through our not-for-profit Proof Positive project.
And let me tell people a reference, because we talked about sexual assault behind the bar. I want to encourage people to go listen to that podcast from about 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. There was a show that we did about that. So our mission statement is we're involved in social justice issues as they relate to food and beverage economies, and specifically sexual violence, education, prevention, and response for bar and restaurant industry professionals. That's really our primary focus. So what we did for National Tip Out Day was we set up a website where we were inviting bartenders to engage with it by signing up to donate a portion or all of their tips on Sunday to a local, to them, sexual violence prevention organization. So we had suggested charities on there, and what we're working on today and this week is the follow-up for those donations. So we had about, I think we were around two dozen in New Orleans who participated, and there was some people who did 30%. There was some people who did 30%, and three different people at their business matched those tips. Shout out to Andy Borbelli at Cooter Browns. He did 100% of his, and then Cooter Browns matched his 100% totally. A few other people did the same thing. Drew and Mandy at Coquette did that. Brett Tilden and I at Tonique, we did our entire day of tips 100%. We raised almost $1,500.
Wow, fantastic. Awesome.
And yeah, it was a great experience. It was a really good learning experience this year. We intend for this to be something that doesn't go away. My and Molly's goal would be that people know that the first Sunday of April every year is National Tip Out Day. That would, you know, mean what I just said. And the more momentum we can get behind this, the more money that we're going to be able to raise, the more awareness that we're going to be able to bring.
So, Mark, let me ask this just so we clarify. So, people, you gave a list of suggested charities, mm-hmm. but then people could choose to donate to a charity of their choice in their area that met the mission.
Exactly. So, you put in your information, and then on the next page, it prompts you to put in the charity's information. And we had a drop-down menu if you didn't know who you wanted to donate to, where you could fill out one of these suggested. Okay. But if you did know, what that meant was you had to put in the website, the name for a contact, either a phone number, an email. And then we would make sure that you exist and that they exist.
As a legitimate nonprofit.
Right. And then what that meant is that if 2 weeks from now the bartender still hasn't made that donation, we've given your information to that charity, and they're just going to put you on their donor list. And so they can do the follow-up to reach out and be like, hey, do you want to make a donation, whatever, whatever. Maybe you forgot, maybe whatever. Maybe you're a jerk and you just wanted the publicity. But we aren't intending to have the infrastructure in place to do that kind of accountability and follow-up.
Handle the money and send the money.
Yeah, within our community, I think that there's enough social accountability that that's not something that we're really concerned about.
Right.
And frankly, if 9 out of 10 people make the donation and one doesn't, whatever. It still was 9 people who made a donation.
Right. Word travels fast, especially in this town and in other places, right?
Oh,
if you were a dog that did that, people are going to find it.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other reasons that we set up the charitable aspect of it in the way that we did, and I was just talking with some of our colleagues about this, this is something that I will emphasize much more heavily next year when we do this. But the idea with asking people to provide their own charity was to create these new collaborative channels within your own community. Mm-hmm. So I have some friends in Arkansas who wanted to do some work for a domestic violence charity up there. That was not on our suggested charity list, right? So, but to do that, they had to get that contact information. Now that charity knows who they are and they know somebody at that charity. So in June, in September, in February, if something comes up, that collaborative channel has been established in that community, sure, where it otherwise might not have had the impetus to begin.
Absolutely. And you know, and this is a really good point, Mark, that just, you know, coming from a nonprofit background myself, as you know, that I've done, is lots of times people in their own backyard know who's doing the good work. Mm-hmm. So allowing them to identify a local charity that they know that they've identified that's doing good work, doing what they're supposed to do with the money, helping the people they need to be mm-hmm. helping. Those are the eyes and ears on the ground, both from the charity side as well as the donor side. And yeah. I think that's a very valid way to go about it.
So I think next year what we'll probably do is spend a little more time when people say that they don't know who they want to reach out to. I think what we'll try to do is a little bit better job of having like leads for each city, which we had a few this year, but there was failings within it and lessons that we learned. But encourage people to know on a larger scale, these are a dozen charities that are in this city, or you know, for us here it was like almost two dozen that we were able to talk to people about. Mm-hmm. But to take the time when we're doing that pitch, going into your bar and visiting, to say, well, are any of these something that you'd be interested in?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
make sure, because a lot of people, I think, will default to the suggested ones, and then they're going to miss that opportunity. So that's something that we're going to put a little bit more emphasis on. I mean, the money's great, but I think any organization would tell you that it is every bit as valuable, and in some ways more, to have an extra set of hands.
Right.
And a bartender who now is reaching hundreds if not thousands of people a week, depending on your venue, and is aware of this program. We have these conversations with people all the time, you know, like if somebody's at the bar and I overhear their conversation where they're talking about their friend who's dealing with these issues, I will interject if I can do so in a polite, productive way.
Right.
And now I have the tools with which to do that.
That's great.
And that's going to telephone down the line. They'll get that help.
Yeah, there you go. And as we've talked about in the subject for another time, as we always talk about, bars are places for folks to socially interact, share ideas, and share these things. It's not just about having a drink. This is a place where you interface with people and can have that conversation.
Before Prohibition, that's what all bars were.
Exactly.
And it's something we've talked about. I'm very much of a mind that it's just today and in the last, you know, 10 years that we're climbing out of Prohibition. Finally,
right.
You know, the a lot of the stigma and stereotypes, whatever, what have you. And again, bigger conversation, but we're finally recovering from. And part of that is the idea of the public house, not just that there's communal tables at this like hipster ass beer bar.
Right.
That this is a community space. You know, like, I mean, it's something that if you go to Europe, they still have
it's
a really good
a salon concept, right?
A salon concept, yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
well,
absolutely.
Mark, do me a favor. So we got about a minute or so left. So tell people, so Proof Positive is the project that you started with our friend Molly Bird. And where do people find that? You guys have a Facebook page, right?
Yeah, we have a Facebook page right now. Our trademark paperwork is going through at the moment.
And all your nonprofit stuff?
We're not buying our website until we have that. Yeah, our nonprofit status is getting reviewed with IRS right now.
That takes
some time. But we're incorporated. We've got a good law firm doing pro bono. Baker Donaldson, which is one of the bigger law firms in New Orleans, is doing all the work pro bono for us,
cool.
which is amazing. You will hear a lot more about Proof Positive Project and the work that we're doing. We have tons of collaborative efforts that are already lined up through the end of the year. We're letting the legalese catch up.
Sure.
We have financial agreements worked out with current nonprofits, so you can make donations to us and still get a write-off and know that it's going to a 501c3.
Yep.
They hold the money until we get it. It's like a whole thing.
Gotcha.
But
for all intents
and purposes, we are up and running.
Okay, cool. We'll circle back once people have the online location to go. We'll talk about it.
Yeah,
and for now. And so first Sunday of every April, National Tip Out Day, we'll circle back on that. Mark, you and I are going to be chatting again in a couple weeks about other things. But buddy, thanks so much for being being here.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate you giving the venue to these type of things.
Always a pleasure, Mark. My friend Mark Scheller, president of the New Orleans chapter of the U.S. Bartenders Guild, as well as one of the founding partners there of Proof Positive and general manager of Bartonique. Friends, thanks for tuning into the Noel Drink Show. We'll be back to wrap things up in just a little bit. Come on back.
Are you tired of drinking the same wines? Switch it up. Try the Kreutz Family Cellars wine. Kreutz Family Cellars is a small, family-owned winery in Sonoma County that makes wines from some of the most prized vineyards throughout Northern California. Each bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines has a magnolia on the label. The magnolia is a symbol of the family's southern roots and their way of life. True, honest, and fun. Look for the magnolia and pick up a bottle of Kreutz Family Cellars wines today.
Hi, New Orleans. It's Laura from Sobu, and I'm here with Chef Juan Carlos.
Sobu's got happier hour. It's 3 to 6 from 3 to 6.
It's bar bars, sips, and snacks, all for $3 to $6 from 3 to 6 p.m. every day.
Laura's got something to please everyone at the bar for happier hour, all for 3 to 6 here at Sobu.
And we know you'll want to try a smoky pulled pork taco or any of the other delicious snacks on our happier hour menu.
Sobu's happier hour, every day from 3 to 6, 310 Charter Street in the quarter.
Complimentary parking next door at the W Hotel.
Hi, I'm Dickie Brennan, and I'd like to invite you to our new Black Duck Bar located on the second floor of Palace Cafe. Named after the Prohibition's infamous rum runner, the Black Duck features over 120 rums as well as an extensive tequila collection. In addition, acclaimed master French chef Rene Bageau heads up the small plates and charcuterie kitchen. Join us for happy hour Monday through Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. with half-price small plates, local draft beer, and tap wine.
All right, friends, welcome back to the NOLA Drink Show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for tuning in this week. I hope you enjoyed our segments there from Bakery Bar. We'll be doing it again next month, as we always do once a month. Interesting characters and figures, if you will, from the service industry joining us. And yeah, if you're in the business, and it doesn't have to be service industry per se, you know, we're kind of looking for people. If you're a chef, maybe you're in the food or beverage production industry, sales, that kind of thing, and you got some on your mind, let us know and drop on by. Can't promise we can always put you on the air if you do, but it's always a lot of fun when people sort of show up. And if you want to drop me a line to see what you have in your head that you want to talk about, I encourage you to let me know, and then I can kind of plan on you coming. You can contact us. And please, and everybody out there, check us out on social media and the web. Our website is noladrinks.com. We have access to all the podcasts of all the previous episodes of the show, which has now been downloaded, the podcast, thousands of times. So I really want to thank everybody out there in the podcast world and all the listeners here, of course. But thanks for tuning in. But check us out on Facebook and Instagram. That's just at NOLA Drinks there. On Twitter, NOLA Drinks. One, the number one. Somebody has NOLA Drinks. I couldn't get that one. I got most of them. All right. And yeah, let us know if you have an idea for a show. Post on our Facebook wall there and let us know what it might be. And again, yeah, if you're interested in coming out to the Bakery Bar and we do it again, should be probably the first Tuesday of next month in May. But we got to make sure we're handling things right. Don't want to interfere with other things going on, but that'll probably be it. We'll announce that. And yeah, drop on by. So that'd be pretty cool. And again, always invite you to connect with the show. And if you do, I really thank you for that too. Wanted to talk about a couple things, a couple bits and bobs, as it were, and I'm using a British expression, so here you go, nice segue. An article out of the from The Independent, their newspaper over there in the UK, and they're talking about the need for alcohol control, potentially in airports. And this is a lot of this stuff was taken from a conversation. There's a law called the Licensing Act of 2003 over there in the UK that apparently does not apply to airport properties. And I think that that's allowing people to be basically cut off and some other things controlling the sales of alcohol. And then a lot of this also talks about an airline called Jet2, which is a budget airline over there in Europe, I believe out of the UK, and talking about the number of passenger disruptions on flights, and their estimate, Jet2, is that over half of all passenger disruptions are related to alcohol. And as a matter of fact, they said this past summer, 536 disruptive incidents took place, and half of those were alcohol-related, so several hundred alcohol-related. And people trying to open cabin doors, people verbally abusing, maybe even physically abusing, I don't say that here specifically, but, you know, being abusive on flights. And I think we've all probably seen that. And one of the things, the point that they're making here, is that pretty easy to drink as much as you want before you get on the plane. And lots of times, as long as you're not being unruly, they will keep serving you on the plane. Now, I think most of us out there are responsible adults. We know our limits. We also know how to handle ourselves in those situations. So, you know, this only happens to a few people, but they were talking about a particular incident where a 21-year-old man was arrested and became abusive towards an entire family on the aircraft. And it was later discovered that he was observed drinking his own alcohol that somehow he brought in, probably in small quantities in the terminal, and then also drinking it on the flight, and then became very abusive. And I think, as we know, these things can be dangerous situations. Planes are sometimes forced to land, things like that. So kind of grappling with that over there in the UK. And so I know it's something that we grapple with here. So I don't know. Well, if I see any more news on this, I'll let you know. But I guess the take-home message here is just don't drink too much when you're flying, friends. Talking about also drinking too much, some things out there related to this article. It's in also from a UK publication called Prima, more of a lifestyle blog. But it's talking about why we all think the title of is why we all think we're rich when we're drunk. And it was they talked to a doctor, Dr. Seth Rankin of London Doctors Clinic, who basically gives us a little bit of a list here about what happens when your brain and you are inebriated. Memory loss, of course, is pretty common. Not just the memory loss the next day, but of course, memory loss of what's going on around you. Drinking makes you forget your worries, so you become a little more cavalier, potentially. So, for example, you forget about how little money you might have, so you keep spending money. So maybe that makes you think you're sort of quote-unquote rich. You also lose your inability to calculate. So maybe you've kind of forgotten how many drinks you've had and what the bill's going to add up to. Mentions also the ease of contactless cards, meaning bank cards. You can just kind of keep throwing that down, keep paying for drinks. Number five here, I like drinking unleashes your inner social butterfly. That's pretty funny. You know, so you're just kind of out there. And part of this kind of relates to number six is that you want to assert your dominance on the group. And a good way to do that, alcohol kind of makes you full of bravado. What better way to be dominant, if you will, in your group in a friendly way, I guess, is to buy drinks. And then the generosity, of course, inflates your mood. You kind of get that feel-good feeling from being generous, buying drinks, positive feedback from others and that sort of thing. So, hey, I guess that's maybe why we all think we're quote-unquote rich when we're drunk. But these are all pretty common things that we know when we're intoxicated. So just something to think about, you know, maybe know your limits both financially as well as drinking wise there. Also, an interesting thing that came out in the Seattle Times, always an interesting question. How much should you tip for a drink, friends? It's an interesting question. They were kind of talking about like pours of whiskey and single pours and things like that. And, you know, how much should you just pour, like very common, somebody you order a canned beer, you throw $1. Almost regardless of the price, you're not going to throw 50 cents, right? That's pretty cheap. So even if it's a $3 beer, you give them $4, right? Something like that. But if it's an $18 pour of whiskey or an $8 pour of whiskey, what do you pay? And they were talking in this article about he and a buddy, the author here, had a couple pours, one each of whiskey, and came to about $50, so drinking some nice stuff. And the guy was going to tip $2 for the shot. But then they thought, well, or for each, you know, for the total, one per shot there, one per each pour. And they started talking about what the proper tip is, and it's kind of an interesting question. You know, just pouring a pour is one thing, but, you know, is it really the bar's reward or the bartender's reward for the price of the drink? So, I mean, meaning if it's a $20 shot versus a $2 shot, should you still just be tipping $1 because a shot's a shot? Interesting question. I mean, you're not really telling you what to do. A lot of people kind of do think that that's the way to go, that some people think it's the standard tip. But then again, if you're making a cocktail, there's a lot more work involved in a cocktail than just pouring a shot. So, you know, I don't know. I'm kind of the mindset that maybe I don't quite tip 20% or that or the like. I do on drinks sometimes plus more than that. But for a shot, maybe $1 or $2 really is kind of appropriate. And there are some interesting things to think about, though, and I like this. A guy named Jim Meehan of PDT, which is in the East Village of New York, a pretty acclaimed cocktail guy out there, and a lot of people listen to what he has to say about the industry, and he had some thoughts, and basically saying there is no flat rule. Don't just go on percentage or if it was a drink or a shot, but especially if it kind of, you know, leaning towards that shot side or individual pours. Kind of easy, maybe just do 15 or 20% on cocktails, but some things to think about across the board. Was the bar busy? Was the bartender attentive, or was it difficult to get the bartender's attention? Ah, service, friends, that's what we're talking about. Did the guest chat with the bartender, or was the interaction solely transactional? Did it seem intrusive? Did the people, quote, like the bartender? Obviously a bit subjective, but, you know, important. Did they know what type of whiskey in this case that they wanted, or did the bartender help them pick? Same thing with drinks, same thing with wine, same thing with anything. Was there knowledge there? Was there guidance there is the point. Was the pour generous, precise, or stingy? Was the glass clean? Did the bartender wait for the cube to temper or pour the whiskey on top too soon and it cracked? Okay, proper pouring technique if you're having something like that on the rocks. Same with a cocktail. Was it delivered properly? Was their spot at the bar kept clean during the experience? Was it clean when they got there? If the bar was busy, did the bartender respect the sovereignty of their space? Meaning, you know, continuing to serve people leaning over you and leaning over you and leaning over you. That's not too cool. Bars need to be set up better that way, by the way, to make sure that that doesn't happen. And guests that walk up to the bar have a place to go do that so they're not leaning over you. Was the bartender entertaining other people and just kind of ignoring you? Or was the bartender talking to sort of everybody, kind of reading the room? Some people want to talk, some people don't. Was the bartender sort of in a dark, miserable black hole of a person? Were they sucking up all the energy in the room? I think we see a lot of that. We see a lot at times. People can be sort of arrogant and have that sort of godlike attitude behind the bar. I think that's what we're getting at here to a degree as well. And did they say thank you when they dropped the check? Did they make eye contact? Was the check presented clean? And you can go on and on, of course, in this, but I think some of those things are interesting. So if you're going to sit there and kind of, I guess the point is, and maybe if you are just doing a shot or sipping on a whiskey or a cognac or one of those, or really any drink, and if you're sitting there for a while and taking up space, you know, the bartender can be turning these places over. And if you're only going to tip a buck or two and you're there for a half an hour, you know, they could be making a little bit more money. So maybe you want to tip a little bit more. I like the idea of considering a bigger picture here, friends. Think about the service. Think about the attitude. Think about the place, the presentation, the aesthetic of the whole experience, and then base your tip accordingly on that. There are no hard and fast rules in any of this. It's, are you happy? Did you get the service you expected? Don't be cheap, though. You know, be generous, but tip accordingly. Don't, if somebody didn't give you good service, they don't deserve a good tip. That's what tips are all about, friends. Friends, thanks for tuning in here to the Noel Drink Show with Brian Diaz. I really appreciate it. We'll be back next week with a good show. We're working on a good one for you. More on that coming down the pike. We hope to see you if you're here in New Orleans out at French Quarter Festival. I'd love to see you. And if not, I'll talk to you next week. And until then, friends, cheers, y'all.